Last time you were here, the hardcover edition of The Kingdom of the Sea had just come out. It's now out in paperback. And we talked quite a bit about your journey around the coast of Britain. But I think it's incumbent upon me to ask you, now that the dust has settled a little bit and there's been several months since the hardcover edition, how are you getting along with the British after the publication of that book? They're not burning crosses in front of your flat, are they?
No, funnily enough, the Kingdom by the Sea didn't win me any permanent enemies. Probably didn't win me that many friends, but no permanent enemies. One an immigration official said to me the last time I was going into Heathrow Airport, when he looked at my passport, said, "You're the writer, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." "So we haven't got rid of you yet?" And I said, "No." And then I said, "I'm still living here." And then he said, "Why? Why are you living here? Why don't you live in, you know, some more pleasant place?" But anyway, I have a number of reasons for living there. But the short answer to the question is that, oddly, the British are fairly objective, or rather, let's say, the English, the Scots, the Welsh, and the Irish are objective about other, their sort of tribal neighbors, but even though they may not be about themselves. And since I was writing about Britain and not only about England, they could say, each group could say, "Well, he was wrong about the English, but he's certainly right about the Irish or the Welsh or the Scots." So I didn't have an axe to grind either, and I think it was basically an affectionate intention.
You've never found yourself ignored or stiffed at cocktail parties?
Well, I don't drink, so I don't go to cocktail parties. Or one of the things about not drinking is that a cocktail party is interminable. So if I go, I'm only there for about half an hour. I'm trying to think whether anyone has been gratuitously rude to me, and I think the answer is no. No, they haven't. People mention it. The book is mentioned as, you know, that book, and Paul Theroux said this or that about us. Most people seem to acknowledge the basic truth of the book. I certainly wasn't trying to settle anyone's hash. I was trying to reach conclusions about the place that I had lived in for 11 years and now 13 years. So, I mean, that's a long trip, really, when you think that's a lot of traveling.
The Kingdom of the Sea was really the first book that I had read that put the English in a rather rude perspective. I had not pictured them in that way before. Maybe I had never thought about it, but you brought them to a sense of reality for me. I had never seen this before.
It's a very interesting country because they really are people like you and me, let's say. But more than that, it's a country which is failing in some ways. It's a very old-fashioned country. And of course, they were the originators of the Industrial Revolution. But for the first time since the Industrial Revolution, Britain has become an importer of manufactured goods. In other words, they're buying stuff from countries that were their customers before. And it's a tremendous blow to their esteem to be in a position where they have to buy more than they sell. And then to realize that the pound is really worth about $1.20. When I went, that was there. I mean, most Americans say, "Ah, the pound, that's about $2, $3, isn't it?" Well, it's getting down to about to parity with the dollar, and that's very hard. It's very hard when you realize. I mean, your currency is always bound up with your self-esteem.
I had pictured the English, and indeed most of the British, as very peaceful, and yet there have been some incidents lately. The bombing at Brighton. The terrible violence involving the coal miners, and I have a feeling that is the fabric in Britain beginning to unravel?
No, I don't think the fabric is unraveling. I think that it's a function of, let's say, civilized, law-abiding society, the really violent incidents that take place are possible and often more common in law-abiding societies than in violent societies. So, in other words, it's very easy to bomb anyone on the subway in New York because no one's checking the bags of people that go in. The Moscow subway might be a bit harder, or a country, say, in Iran or Turkey, where they do have bombings. It would be hard to carry out a terrorist bombing campaign. But in a country like Britain, and let's say in a city like London, violence is a tremendously easy thing to perpetrate because there's so Because movement is so easy for people. You know, bags aren't usually checked when you. I mean, they're never checked when you go into the subway. So that and the Brighton bombing. Can you imagine the whole British cabinet, including the Prime Minister, all staying in the same hotel?
That's not going to happen again.
It won't happen again. But it's a tremendous sort of complacency. Thinking, well, this is a safe, law-abiding, civilized country. They're not saying nothing bad's going to happen to us. It just never occurred to them that that was a bad idea. Well, of course, they're not going to do that again. But one of the things that you can count on is that there will continue to be bombs in England and in London streets. And as last year there was a bomb in a lot of Christmas shoppers were blown up by the IRA last Christmas. It will happen again. You can be fairly certain of it.
Why do you live in England?
I live there mainly because my wife is English and has a job there. And for about 9 years of our married life, I had said, well, we're going to Uganda, we're going to Singapore, where I have a job. And when I quit teaching for good and took up writing full-time and could live anywhere, I said, okay, well, we'll live where you have a job in the way that you had gone where. Where I had a job. Now we're about even, and I think, and our children are getting out of the equivalent of high school, and I think I have a tremendous homing instinct. I mean, I like living in the States. I have a house on the Cape, and I like going there. So my instincts really are informing me to come back. I mean, compelling me, let's say. And
you're in the States for the summer.
Always in the summer and usually in the spring, usually about 4 or 5 months a year.
Do you have a house or an apartment in London? Is it London that you
have?
Yeah,
I have a house in London.
In the city itself?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A house?
Yeah, in South London.
Mm-hmm. You work in the house. Do you have a room, an office or something in the house?
Yeah, I have, for tax purposes, 2/9 of the house. There are 9 rooms in the house and 2 of them I use as working room. One a library and the other is a study, let's say.
For tax purposes, I guess you really need that.
And actual purposes. I mean, that's a real, because the tax people visit you there, and they say, ah, yes, what is this 2/9? And where is this car that you, you know, and where is this typewriter that you bought? And they ask you questions like that. They do.
They actually visit?
Yeah, they check up on you. They've visited me 3 times. But I'm an alien, you see. And I live as an alien. I can't vote. I can't run for parliament. I'm merely a tax-paying alien.
You have an English accent, almost an English accent. Was this a natural happenstance of your living there so long, or did you have it because of your background as a New Englander?
It probably sounds as if I have an English accent, but in England, I was once on the telephone and a man told me to go back to Jamaica. Thinking, of course, that I was a West Indian. So I think I probably have a West Indian accent. But I've lived outside the States since 1963. I mean, I joined the Peace Corps in 63 and went to Central Africa. And I think accents are funny. I mean, they do sort of rub off, I suppose. But
well,
I'm not conscious of it.
I've been trying to ditch my Middle Western accent without any luck. It's still with me. Your new novel, Half Moon Street, that was published in England as Dr. Slaughter, wasn't it?
Yes. The first story in it was published, which is called Dr. Slaughter,
and as a separate book.
Yes.
And it didn't have the Dr.
Demar. No, it didn't. When I wrote The Kingdom by the Sea, I realized that I was writing about the coast of Britain, and that I was describing everything but London. I mean, no place in England is more than 65 miles from the ocean. So I thought, well, this is, if you describe the ocean or the seashore, I thought I would be describing Britain. But London is a special case. In the way that New York is, I mean, cities are like independent republics. And so you can describe a country, or describe the United States or Britain, and you can make certain generalizations, but the exceptions are always the cities. And people who live in cities are like citizens of a republic, and they make their own rules. I mean, it's true of New York in a way that it's probably true of, it's truer of New York than of a lot of other cities, but London is one of the, let's say, metropolitan republics of the world. I mean, it takes as long to go from one part of London to another as to cross Belgium, I sometimes think, because it's of the traveling. And New York, too, that you have this feeling that you're traveling a tremendous distance. Actually, you're just inching along very slowly.
Yes, from 5th to 6th Avenues.
Yeah, right.
That takes 45 minutes right there, holiday time.
Yes, it's hell. It's hell. It's very abrading on the nerves. It's probably why people in cities live very indoor lives.
So you set your novel, Dr. Slaughter, in London.
Yes, I was trying to think, how do you go about describing a city? I know how you describe a country. You walk, take buses, take trains, and so forth, and you can do it in the first person. The Kingdom by the Sea is essentially a book about moving overland around the coast of Britain. But I thought to write about London, I'd have to conceive of someone who is leading a double life, and because there is a double life that cities have. There's a sort of secret life, private life, and that's the real life of the city. It's not the obvious, superficial life of just of people. You know, in the Japanese phrase, they call it the floating world, the people just sort of moving back and forth, and the people that you see and the things that you see. It's that sort of the hidden interior existence that cities have. And I thought, well, a political scientist who is also a social escort, a sort of prostitute political scientist, a woman who would penetrate both worlds, is really the best way of showing how the city lives, how it operates. It also shows, I mean, I was trying to write about London and through the eyes of an American who realizes that this is a city of multiple layers. It's also a city that doesn't belong to the English, that it's a sort of cockpit for political intrigue in the way that I mentioned that Britain being violent.
Lawrence Slaughter, of course, initially became an escort and ultimately a prostitute.
Actually, she seemed to like it. Even after she no longer needed money, she continued doing it, except for that moment after she was kidnapped and robbed. She had to turn, I think, as you put it in the book, 9 tricks in that one brief night. Hmm. But isn't that unusual that she would be a political scientist and yet enjoy being a prostitute?
Well, she's not a prostitute in the classic sense, in the sense of sort of turning tricks, as they say. I suppose she is on that in that particular episode. But most of the time, she's being required to do something that classically prostitutes were not asked to do. She's an escort who has to be presentable, has to be able to understand the Arab world, oil prices, recycling oil revenues, pipelines, intrigues. It's not so much, it's not bed as so much as the boardroom or, let's say, economic developments. She's taken to parties. She's sort of courtesan, really. So that sex isn't uppermost in her customers' minds, nor is it in her own mind. She feels that she has a kind of power that comes from being an intelligent observer of world affairs. It's when she's being a political scientist as a kind of underpaid hack that men are pinching her bottom and treating her like a hooker. And I mean that it's often true that the sexism in an office, I mean, a lot of men treat women in that kind of presumptuous way, but in a kind of casually sexist way. But an escort expects something a bit more than that.
Why did you decide to include Dr. DeMar with Dr. Slaughter to make the book Half Moon Street?
Because
in this country, in the American edition.
Because I was fascinated. After I wrote The Kingdom by the Sea, I started to think very deeply about double lives and, say, the private life of a city, of a country, of a person, and the way that the secret life that a person leads is his real life, and that this hidden life that she's living is her life. That Dr. DeMar is also a sort of double life story where a twin is interchangeable for his brother, this identical twin. But I was also thinking the perfect murder story is a twin dies. The surviving brother takes his place and wonders how did my brother die? Then he dies. And in dying, finds out how his brother died. In the process of being killed, he finds out how his brother died. But, I mean, it requires a certain element of sacrifice, which he was unaware of at the beginning. But obviously the most obvious thing is that... the most obvious thing is that this person is unaware. You think of yourself as a totally unique individual. A twin does. But the world thinks of you as simply the shadow of your twin.
Let's go back a little bit to the Mosquito Coast, which I thought was just absolutely a wonderful novel, and that's set in Honduras.
Yes.
You obviously spent a lot of time there.
Quite a bit, not as much as you might think, to tell you the truth. Because it's a very difficult country to travel in, Honduras. It's a place where you might get on a missionary plane or go up a river on a boat, but in general you can't go yomping through the jungle. It's not exactly impenetrable, but it's a rather inhospitable jungle, leeches, and there are a lot of bugs, insects, and so forth, snakes. I did what I could. I did spend quite a bit of time. I mean, I didn't spend years there. I was going to say, I lived in Singapore for 3.5 years and wrote a book about it, St. Jack. But I was only in, the total that I was in Honduras was only a couple of months. I consider that a very short amount of time.
You've certainly made good use of your travels around the world, haven't you?
Well, yes, although I will say that I haven't gone in search of material. I've always gone with the intention of enjoying myself, satisfying my curiosity, and I'm sure that I would travel if I didn't write. You know, that it's not, that writing isn't uppermost in my mind. In fact, travel is a lot easier if you don't write. It's the process of writing can turn travel into a real ordeal, as you realize every night that you live through the day, but also that you have to nail it down, reach a conclusion, write about it, and be concrete. And if nothing happens to you that day, there's really nothing to write. I mean, the classic example being in a hotel room in Osaka in Japan in 1974. And I was thinking, I was writing the Great Railway Bazaar then. What do I write about? I mean, I'm here in this strange city. No one will talk to me. I don't speak the language. This hotel, I might as well be in Bangor, Maine. Now what? I was thinking. But of course, the logical answer to that is you write about thinking that you're in Bangor, Maine, in this anonymous. And write about, I thought, write truthfully about the quandary that I'm in, being in this strange city, not understanding the city, but writing about the experience of alienation. Let's see.
To kind of wrap things up, I want to ask you about the craft of writing as it deals with your fiction. How do you approach a work of fiction such as Half Moon Street or The Mosquito Coast or St. Jack? You are sitting in a room, presumably, and what happens next?
Well, it doesn't happen very quickly. I think that the process of writing fiction, and particularly of writing a novel, is something that goes on for quite a long time. I got the idea for writing The Mosquito Coast when I was taking the trip on the old Patagonian Express. I went through Central America and I thought, this is a part of the world that I didn't realize existed. I mean, I really liked Central America. I thought it was interesting. Empty, of course, poverty-stricken, but unfairly presented. I mean, they've been tyrannized by dictators. And I thought, well, I wanted to write an adventure story, a story about castaways, people who sort of wash up on a coast, try to make something, and then everything goes wrong. People with ideals. So I thought, an adventure story, castaways, where should this take place? Maybe not in the country that I've already written about, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, but I thought, what about Honduras? Well, I haven't written about that. And I thought, I'll go to Honduras, see what's there. Then, so all this was sort of percolating over a year or two. Then I sat down, I started thinking about it, and I thought, it's perfect. Well, why would an American family leave? They would leave because they thought that oil prices were too high. Or in the way that people were threatening to leave during the 70s, during the oil crisis, people were saying, you know, this, it's not working out here. It's not working out. Inflation is very high. The Arabs are taking over. Why don't we leave? Why don't we try it somewhere else? People were threatening. You know, let's do something else. Maybe I'm in the wrong line. let's go to Alaska, let's go somewhere else. Of course, no one went, but I thought, well, what if you followed through? What if a person followed through? So anyway, I was thinking all this. Then I sat down and started writing.
Now, do you just sit down and start writing, or do you outline this novel?
No, I didn't outline the novel. I actually have this feeling when I start a novel. I think about it quite a lot, but I actually can see the whole book before me. And I sometimes think, it's done, it's finished. This book is complete. I see it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. I see the characters, the tone, it's funny, it's sad. It's all there. And then I start writing, I think, oh my goodness. It's not written. But there is a point before I begin when I can see the whole book. And even a travel book like The Kingdom by the Sea or Mosquito Coast or Half Moon Street, there's a point before I begin when I can see it whole. Then I start writing, and it's almost as if that vision is receding. And as the more I write, the further I'm away. I'm sort of working against that. And the thing is receding into the darkness. I'm trying to capture this vision of the book, or let's say groping around in the dark, putting it all together, and then when it's done, I say, ah, yes, that's the book that I had in mind, and it all seems as if it came out all right.
Have you ever taught creative writing?
No, thank goodness, I've never taught.
Would you want to do something like that?
I think it would be very hard. I think I'm a little too cynical about teaching creative writing. If I taught creative writing, what I would do is I would be a real tyrant in getting people to read. I would have them read everything and write about what they were reading. I'd have them read Joyce, Chekhov, everything, short stories, novels, everything that they had never read before. And after this tremendous reading experience, then I'd say, okay, now go off, now you're ready to start writing. But first you have to see how difficult it is.
Presumably, if you were to teach creative writing on a college level, they should have read much of that material.
You would think so, but in the experience that I've had as a student, I think that it's the conceit of the writing student. First, writing is considered a soft option. Secondly, people think, I'm not a reader. I'm not here to read. What I want to do is write. I want to write about this guy who's got problems, you know, this guy, or romantic problems, or this world beater, something like that. And a person imagines himself being a writer rather than writing.
Well, Paul Theroux, our studio time is just about up. I have a million more questions I could ask, but I'll have to save them, I think, for the next time you're in town, and I hope to get back together with you and talk some more. And I want to thank you very much for coming in and chatting with me.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.